Thursday edition of the Hagmann Report. We're going to be joined by a journalist from the American Thinker, Lori Lowenthal Marcus, in just a few moments. Again, we just were joined by Carl Gallops, who told us some interesting news about the Obama birth certificate investigation that they've launched. And we have the huge news of the day, Trump recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And what you said earlier, in 1995, the Congress passed a bill that basically states all presidents recognize Jerusalem as the capital, but they sign a waiver every 6 months to never really implement that change. And now Trump is implementing the change, and it is drawing huge backlash from the media here and people all across the world. And what's interesting to me is, you know, they're saying that this is going to set the world on fire. Trump's move to move the capital from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem is going to set the world on fire. But they didn't say that when Obama was launching the Arab Spring, you know, destabilizing nation after nation after nation.
That was an organic movement.
Yeah. So we see the hypocrisy there, and we're going to get into the embassy and Israel more with our guest Lori Lowenthal Marcus in just a few moments.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear what she's got to say. Let me ask you a question. Are you enthused about going to the mall or going shopping for a Christmas present this year? Are you just psyched up about it? Hey, the holidays are fast approaching, right? You don't have to ever leave your house. I have got the perfect gift for that hard-to-buy person or that very special person, or even for yourself, omahasteaks.com. That's right. Give the gift of fantastic aged beef. Oh, my goodness. Think about this. It could be snowing out. It doesn't matter. Put a filet mignon on the grill, on a charcoal grill, and can you smell it? Can you just taste that perfectly aged beef? Oh, there's nothing like a good steak. Have it for yourself or give it to that special someone in your lives. Go to Omaha Steaks. Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks and how, for under $50, for only $49.99, you can get my family gift pack when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter our code HH in the search bar. That's 75% off. Now, in addition to that, they offer over 500 gourmet gift ideas, great steak experiences at home. You don't have to go out. They've got seafood, poultry, pork, veal, lamb, veggies, desserts, appetizers, pasta, soups, everything. You could spend a long time just perusing their website. Their beef is aged over 21 days to unlock the full flavors of the cuts, and they're all hand-trimmed and vacuum-sealed, and it's great to get it because it comes to your door in this insulated, self-refrigerated box, if you will. And I love the just, hey, I just walk out, pick up the box, bring it in, and there it is. There are my steaks right there. Right now, Omaha Steaks is giving an exclusive savings just to you, the listeners of the Hagmann Report. Listen to everything that you will get for under $50. Are you ready? Two filet mignons, two top sirloins, two boneless pork chops, four boneless chicken breasts, four steak burgers, four potatoes au gratin, four caramel apple tartlets, and we do have wrestling matches in the studio between John the producer and Eric the tech over the caramel apple tartlets, and four kielbasa sausages plus. Listen to this. You'll get an additional four kielbasa sausages free, and of course the favorite, the steaks seasoning packet. It's just fantastic. How do you get all this? Simple. Go to omahasteaks.com. That's omahasteaks.com. Enter HH in the search bar, and you know what comes up? The My Family Gift Pack. That's right. omahasteaks.com, HH in the search bar, My Family Gift Pack. And hey, look, there's so many things you can choose from that while you're there. Give the gift of food. Give the gift of great food. Give this gift to that person who's hard to buy for. And while you're at it, make sure you get one for yourself. OmahaSteaks.com, HH in the search bar. So many things going on, Joe, especially with Jerusalem and with the Mideast. And
yeah,
this is the timetable, isn't it? I think that this is God's timetable.
Well, we're going to get into that now with our guest, Lori Lowenthal Marcus. And Lori was a litigator in a major Philadelphia law firm before teaching in area law and graduate schools on various topics, including First Amendment law and law and social policy. Marcus is a member of the Israel Advocacy Task Force of the Greater Philadelphia Federation of Israel Campus Initiative and of Israel Campus Coalition, and is on the board of the Philadelphia Hillel. Marcus writes about Middle East policy and has been published in various local, national, and international media. She's also earned a JD from Harvard University, a master's law in social policy, and master's in policy and program development from Bryn Mawr.
Okay. Yeah, Bryn Mawr.
And we have Lori on with us, so she just dropped off. We're going to get her right back.
She has got a resume that goes out the door.
I'm going to tell you. Extensive bio there.
Yeah, and she's very well known. And of course, as you stated, she writes for American Thinker. So,
yeah.
But one of the issues, the key issues here that coming out the door, we've got to ask her about President Trump's announcement today with respect to the U.S. Embassy, Jerusalem. And now she's given so many seminars. She's given, sometimes spoken to hundreds of people in the same room, as few as half a dozen people, you know.
On law, she's done them on sexual harassment.
Yep, yep.
And she's got an article that we're going to get into, the big law firm Casting Couch, where she details her own accounts and her own history in the world of sexual harassment. Yeah, but she also uses that experience to teach and inform others on how to handle and deal with situations like this.
I mean, we want to give a special thanks to Thomas Lifson at American Thinker. Thank you, Tom, very much. Thank you, Thomas Lifson, American Thinker, for putting together a great cadre of writers, authors, including our own Peter Chowka, which, by the way, if you haven't done so already, check his article out again, or check his article out on Hagman Report. Now, it's down at the bottom of the page, but there it is, exclusive, Impeaching Nixon versus Taking Down Donald Trump. Eric, just give us a thumbs up when we have our guest. Okay, we think we do. So, let's bring her on.
Lori, are you there?
All right. We're not hearing anything at the moment here.
All right. No, we're not. We'll get it figured
out. Lori Lowenthal Marcus, again, a litigator in a major Philadelphia law firm before teaching in area law, and a resume that goes out the door. And, of course, talking about Jerusalem. And this is big news, at least in my view. How many of all of our past presidents have had the courage to do what Donald Trump has done? And I think it takes a fair amount of courage to stand up and say, look, we respect you. And can you imagine any other nation telling the United States, well, we're not going to recognize D.C. as your capital. We're going to recognize New York City, and that's where we're going to put our embassy, keep our embassy.
Well,
the heck with you.
It is a big deal, but at the same time, it's not. It shouldn't be that big of a deal. Jerusalem historically has been the capital of Israel, all the way back to, you know, biblical times in the Old Testament. And, you know, we know the media, how rabid anti-Trump they are. And any and everything that he does, they come against him anyway. So this is no different. I mean, literally, he could appoint Hillary Clinton to be the vice president, and they'd probably find something wrong with him for doing that. But, I mean, their response to this is always insane. What's really interesting is to see the response from other world leaders, and specifically what we talked about earlier, the Pope and the Prime Minister Netanyahu. It's interesting to see where they stand on this. But I think we do have our guest, Lori Lowenthal Marcus. Welcome to the Hagman Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are being told by our technician that we got you on audio, but we don't have your video queued up.
So
I'm not sure if we can get that figured out, but we can move ahead either way.
I think there's a video camera with a line through it, perhaps.
That work?
Let's see. Yeah, there you go.
Perfect.
All right. Yeah. All right. There we go. Well, thank you so much for appearing on our show. We have so much to get into. We want to tap into your expertise, your knowledge about the announcement today. What are your thoughts? I mean, let me ask you this. What questions should we be asking, and what should we be focused on with respect to this particular announcement?
Well, I think that you should be watching what happens in the Arab world, but you need to keep in mind that across the Arab world, there is going to be condemnation. What will be very interesting to see is what kind of response they have directly to President Trump, if there is any cutting of ties with President Trump. My guess is that although even Saudi Arabia will condemn President Trump's statement, there will actually be a degree of complacency and lack of surprise and an agreement that in fact this announcement is long overdue. Now there will be rioting, no doubt, in lots of other Arab countries. But, you know, it takes very little to set them off. And for far too long, the United States government has been complying with and appeasing the terrorists. If someone threatens to take some bad action, if you do something, and you continue to take bad action, whether or not you do something, President Trump was exactly right. They need to be punished. The terrorism needs to be punished. And by saying, okay, for so many years, for over 20 years, we refrained from taking this important action. And now, because of your misbehavior, we are taking this unilaterally. We are going to, despite your threats, we are going to take this step forward. And unless you come to the table and stop making threats, you will continue to be displeased. So it's important to watch what happens, but not just pay attention to what's said, but see what actually happens. See what actions people actually take. If President Abbas, for example, or I shouldn't call him president, he's served more than 11 years of four-year term, so the acting leader of the Palestinian Authority. If he cuts off relations, as he threatened to do with the United States, he really will be cutting off his own, not just the hand that feeds him, but the spigot that pours funds into his coffers and those of his people.
Well, exactly, and I find it interesting. It's being reported in the Daily Mirror, for example, that Abbas is stating that the United States, by making this announcement, is actually withdrawing from the peace process. I found that statement to be a little bit absurd, actually, but okay.
And Lori, what you said in the beginning, that you know, Trump's action in recognizing Jerusalem of the capital is going to draw violence from the other side, and the media painting this as a reason not to do this. It's the same mentality they have when, you know, terrorism is called out for being radical Islamic terrorists. Then you see the media saying, well, don't call it that. You're going to inspire more attacks. I mean,
right, right. Thereby proving the point.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. So, my guess is that we will see, you know, they've called, first of all, who calls for 3 days of rage? If you have rage, you express that you don't have a limit on it. And also, you know, do you have any idea how many days of rage we have had over all kinds of things? I don't think there's going to be anything different. And we haven't had peace. What kind of peace process is going to be thwarted? We don't have a peace process.
That's a great point. And that's why I love your writing style too, by the way. You make some very good points. Yeah, we'll have 3 days of rage. And then what? Peace after that? But
I'll tell you, if I can tell you a quick story.
Sure.
I lived in Israel a few years ago for most of a year. And there was one of these perpetual, you know, days of rage. Jerusalem into the old city and see what happens on a day of rage. But that day it was raining, so we had a day of rain and no one showed up. I mean, it's really, there are such hollow statements.
Man, I'll tell you, exactly. Well, okay, if you don't mind, treat me like an elementary school student. Historically, Explain to me historically the just briefly the history of Jerusalem being the capital of Israel and the political aspect from the 1948 declaration of statehood to the present. Just kind of give me a kind of a Cliff Notes version, if you don't mind, for our audience as well, just so we know that we're all on the same page in terms of the backdrop of what we're witnessing today.
Okay, well, if you want to start with 1948, of course, we're cutting off thousands of years of history of the Jewish connection to Jerusalem, and of course, King David founded Jerusalem as the capital of the Jewish people. But in 1948, there was the United Nations then said that this was the first two-state solution. There was going to be two states, and part of Jerusalem, Jerusalem at that time was divided by the international community, and part of Jerusalem was going to be given to the Arabs, and the other part, what we now call the western part of Jerusalem, was to be given to the Jewish people. But of course, the Arab peoples never accepted the division because they didn't want the Jewish people to be entitled to any part, actually of the entire region, not just Jerusalem. So there was a war of independence, and there was eventually an armistice, and then the Jewish people did accept their territory. Begrudgingly, of course, but look, they were thrilled to have a state and thrilled to have at least access to some of Jerusalem. And fast forward to 1967, when there was the attack by, well, first of all, there was the fight between Egypt and Israel, and the other Arab nations, Jordan in particular, and Syria, decided to come in with the Egyptians. The Egyptians said, oh, we're winning the war, come on in and you'll get great pieces of this territory. And the eastern part of Jerusalem is where Jordan was, and frankly, illegally occupying. They had never been granted sovereignty for that area.
That's a very important point, too. I think a lot of people miss that. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, that's a very important point. And we should mention, perhaps, that the Jordanians, when they had control over the Temple Mount and the parts of the old, all of the old city and the parts of eastern Jerusalem, they didn't allow Jews or Christians to worship as they wanted. And the Jordanians also took the Mount of Olives, one of the most ancient and most holy cemeteries in history in the world, and used the Jewish gravestones for latrines and things like that. So they were not good caretakers. In 1967, to get back to where we were in the narrative, the Jordanians and the Syrians did come in with the Egyptians, although the Egyptians were actually crushed. The Egyptian Air Force was crushed by tiny, tiny Israel. And the Prime Minister and the Israeli government begged the Jordanians not to engage. The Israelis promised the Jordanians that there would be no attack on them if the Jordanians refrained from attacking Israel. The Jordanians did not refrain. They came in and attacked the Jewish state. The Jews beat back, the Israelis, I should say, beat back both the Jordanians and took control of territory as far out as what people, well, it's Judea and Samaria. People frequently refer to that as the West Bank. But the Jewish state conquered that area in a defensive war. They conquered that territory from a non-sovereign, and the same thing happened up in the Golan Heights when Syria attacked the Jewish state at the same time that Israel was fighting against Egypt and Jordan, and Israel gained territory, specifically the Golan Heights, from Syria. So that's where the status was, excuse me, when there was a cessation of hostilities. And for some strange reason, the territory that the Jewish state had acquired, once again in a defensive war from non-sovereigns, was treated as occupied by Israel. And so when we call, when people call, not me, but others, and most of the mainstream media, of course, call the Judea and Samaria as occupied territory or occupied Palestinian territory, occupied, of course, by the Jewish state, they're talking about something that is simply not accurate.
It's a false narrative.
It's a
false depiction, false narrative, false description.
Exactly. And, right. Of course, so the old city and the area that we're talking about today, the big change that President Trump has announced, of course, the Jewish state, the Israelis are saying, you know, well, of course, Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, but the United States, particularly during the past administration, Israel was a nation without a capital, and Jerusalem was a city without a home. So the statement by President Trump is huge.
Fantastic. And thank you for that backdrop. I think a lot of people have to contextualize how we got here. And, mm-hmm. you know, so the significance cannot be, I don't think it can be understated.
Yeah. Right, Joe. And, you know, many of the critics of this are saying that, you know, Trump is undoing decades long work of putting together this peace process, when in reality they're no closer to a peace process now than they ever were. And keeping the embassy in Tel Aviv certainly was not, and recognizing Tel Aviv as the capital was certainly not furthering that goal. After the dust settles from this move, do you see the two sides coming together for a peace deal? Many people speculate, because Trump, you know, is the author of the art of the deal and is known for his deal-making abilities, that he would be the president to usher in a peace deal. Do you see that in the future?
I don't. I don't see peace coming anytime soon to the region. And I say that with great sadness. I'm in Israel a lot, and I have lost friends to the terrorism and to the wars, and as have so many others. But I'll tell you, these people have been educated for terrorism, and they have hatred inculcated generation after generation. And until that is addressed, we're not going to have peace. I actually met with a young man who is a Palestinian Muslim who lives in, to his great despair, in what is called a refugee camp. And he told me, I was there several months ago, and he told me that they are taught that everything that's wrong with their lives is the fault of the Israelis. And his eyes were slowly opened, mostly because he began to do research about the corruption of the Palestinian Authority, and to see the homes of some of the leadership, the lavish homes, and realizing that he and his family for generations now have been living in squalor, and it isn't the fault of the Israelis, it's the fault of their own leadership. And until we get people like him to share this information and help others of his generation open their eyes, we're not going to have peace. But I'll tell you what we are going to have. We're not going to have a continuation of the appeasement of terror. And so something may change, if only because there will be, I imagine, there will eventually be a revolution by the Palestinian Arabs, whose lives are miserable because of the oppression by their own leadership. That's what's going to bring change.
Interesting. And that's okay. And I think that's important for people to understand as well, the growing discontent and the realization of what the real oppression is. And it's not coming from Israel. It's coming from the leadership of the Palestinians against their own
That's
people.
That's correct.
Okay.
That I firmly, firmly believe that. If I can just give you a hint of my own view, a theory that I have.
Sure.
That is, if you listen to people talk about the end of the peace process and the end of peace and furthering peace and what is shutting the window on peace discussions, what they really mean by peace is a Palestinian state. They don't mean peace. And for too long, what has been called a peace process has had as its goal, its end goal, a Palestinian state rather than peace. And a Palestinian state without infrastructure and leadership and democracy and education and, for heaven's sake, irrigation and all the other things that countries need to survive, until those things happen, there isn't going to be peace. And to create a Palestinian state before they are ready is going to doom everyone in the region.
Interesting.
So watch that. Peace means Palestinian state. Just watch when you hear it from the leftists.
Oh, okay. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I've been saying this, that, you know, this political correct movement that we see and how the media is, you know, with this social justice ideology, that their anti-Semitism is really going to shine forth when talking about Jerusalem and Israel and these issues. And I know that they can't contain it. It's going to come out. But I think it's really going to show their hypocrisy. And again, when they're siding with terrorists, and, you know, every day that we see terrorist attacks and they're siding with the Palestinians, it's not a far leap to see, you know, how they're going to become unhinged about this. And, it's just amazing to me that how far gone the media in this country is. But anyway.
Yeah. But, No, if I may, there's going to be a meeting of the UN Security Council this coming Friday, at the request of 8 states, the 15-member body over this decision. Any thoughts on what's going to take place then during this meeting?
Well, all I can say is thank goodness we have Nikki Haley in the UN, because she is one tough, fabulous, rock-hard lady who is going to not take any reprimands sitting down. I'm sure that there will be widespread criticism. We know that the Organization of Islamic States has great, great control over the United Nations. They are a majority in the United Nations, and that is the reason why we see Israel as consistently the one nation that is condemned repeatedly, the one nation where there are Security Council hearings to condemn its self-defense against terrorism. So I'm sure that we will see more of the same, and we'll see harsh condemnations. We'll see how far they go, though, because President Trump has already threatened to remove funding. You know, the United States provides more than 24% of the funding for both the United Nations and its organization, its subsidiary organizations. And so that's a big stick to hit back with. So we'll see what he's going to do. I don't know, but I'm sure this was anticipated and they are prepared.
Okay. You know, it's interesting to think it was, what, a year ago, right about this time when Obama... under Obama, the U.S. abstained at the U.N. vote, and I'm trying to remember, that was an abstention with respect to the settlements, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, the occupation.
Wow, what a whiplash of foreign policy! It's amazing to think at the stark differences between Obama then a year ago and President Donald Trump now.
Well, one thing you can't say about Trump is that he doesn't keep his promises. Obama promised to do this. Bush promised to do this. Trump has also promised to do this, but he is the one to follow through with it.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. The law passed in 1995, and right. Every president since then has signed the waiver and not recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. President Trump both recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and said that he has begun the process. And in fact, Secretary of State, who has not always been the best friend of Israel, but he, Secretary of State Tillerson, also said that the process has begun to move the embassy.
Wow.
That the process is underway. And,
yes.
It'll be interesting to see.
Amazing.
The response now from, people on the ground from other nations, as well as people also here in the United States. Everybody's got their opinion, and they want to, you know, all tear down Trump. So I'm sure we won't have any shortage in the next 2 days of topics relating to this.
Our guest is Lori Lowenthal Marcus. If you don't mind, tell people where they can find your work, obviously at American Thinker. If you've got any social networks, Twitter, Facebook, just please give them out.
Right. Well, on Facebook, it's Lori Lowenthal Marcus, and I post pretty much what I'm thinking about, what I'm reading, and what I'm writing on my Facebook page. So that's the go-to source for what I'm writing and thinking about. I'm also on Twitter at Lori L. Marcus. And I have written for 4 years. I wrote just about 6 days a week at thejewishpress.com. So that's another place to look for my writing.
Fantastic. And your work is fabulous as well at American Thinker. We do follow your articles, read your articles, and find them informative and spot on, obviously.
The latest being the big law firm Casting Couch, and this is the wake of all the sexual harassment, misconduct, and assault allegations that are plaguing the world of politics, media, and entertainment.
Oh, man. I asked Joe, and I read this. Am I reading this right? Wow. Okay. Go ahead, Joe.
And it's interesting, Lori, because you not only talk about your own experience you've had with sexual harassment in the workplace, but you also you speak at universities and at seminars, giving people insight as to how to deal with sexual harassment in the workplace and in schools and in other professional settings.
That's right. After my experience, which was pretty awful, but my response to my experience was to learn everything I could about sexual harassment, and I became such an expert that I began giving seminars to major companies, small companies all across the country. And then I began to even do investigations into sexual harassment complaints. This was my response to my trauma. I took control and understood the law and how it works better than anyone else, so that I felt in control. And one thing that's really important, and I heard it all the time when I used to fly around the country giving these seminars, I would tell someone what I was doing, and invariably, if I was sitting next to a man, the man would say, "Oh, well, you can't even say a woman looks pretty anymore, or that she's nice," and that's just not true. Even if the woman, particularly now that we have all these snowflakes, even if the woman feels uncomfortable with your statements, that does not make out a claim of sexual harassment. So this is as a former practicing lawyer, this is the one area of the law that I can say with confidence the incentives are really set up in the right places to make people do the right thing. The problem is that that companies are rarely forced to follow the right policies, and that's their downfall, because without them, they don't have a defense, and that's what we're seeing all over. All these companies, excuse me, are losing. Yeah.
I that happens to me all the time when I'm on.
Yeah, that happens here constantly.
So
on
sorry.
Other programs. Oh, no, no worries.
I saw a study earlier this week that it was about millennials surveyed about what they felt was equal to sexual harassment or what was sexual harassment, and it found, I think it was 65% said things like a man asking a woman out for a drink or telling a
crazy
woman
stuff.
That she looks pretty was sexual harassment. And they were explaining, the article was explaining just what you were talking about, that you know, there is this line that people are drawing, that even it's not sexual harassment, but they're trying to claim it is. And I don't know if it's part of this kind of victim mentality that we have, but we've had these issues in the workplace and for so long, yet it was kind of swept under the rug. Now we're seeing this over explosion of exposure of it, mm-hmm. and it's like this hypersensitivity to it, and you know, people, you know, due process is being thrown out. We mm-hmm. just see with, you know, Al Franken, obviously he even admitted to being guilty, but we're seeing women come out and make accusations, and then these mad dashes of people calling
guilty.
for resignations without, you know, proof. Or I mean, how do we untangle all this, and how do we weed through this while in continuing to do the right thing?
Well, it depends what you mean by we, because employers have an obligation to act. And in fact, they have an obligation to act even if the person who is allegedly sexually harassed doesn't want their employer to take any action. The company has to. And so they need to be vigilant about bad behavior, really bad behavior. But if they look into a problem quickly and resolve the issue, then it doesn't constitute sexual harassment. It's really hard. I mean, particularly, let me back up for a second. There are two different kinds of sexual harassment. One is called quid pro quo, and that's when someone in a position of authority either threatens to withhold something that an employee is entitled to, or to reward the employee if they will engage in some sexual activity. That's quid pro quo, and that's pretty straightforward if you can prove it. The other one, the more common kind, is hostile work environment. And there has to be a pattern. There has to be really egregious behavior over time that would constitute sexual harassment, so that if a company hears that someone is telling, you know, really off-color jokes or making fellow workers uncomfortable and perhaps following an employee home or something like that, then the company has to take action. Once they respond and start taking action, then they have a defense. Another problem, of course, is what about those who are being accused? And I'm having a little bit of a hard time feeling real sorry for some of these men where there are pictures of the man, you know, groping a sleeping woman, for example, in the case of Al Franken. You know, I'm sorry. That is really inappropriate behavior. And we have proof. We know you did this. So, due process for him, I think, you know, once there's proof, they're less of, less, you know, liable to incur some sort of leeway. But for others, you do need to do the investigations. Now, my guess is, and as we're hearing now, particularly with someone like Matt Lauer, you know, he was fired, as we heard, peremptorily. We heard the announcement, and he was gone that day. What about due process? Well, it turns out, as we now know, that NBC knew about his behavior. In fact, they laughed about it. There was a roast of Matt Lauer where people told all kinds of stories about his bad behavior, and this was several years ago. So, again, this is the employer covering their own rear end. They're not acting, you know, in a way that, oh my goodness, someone complained about our star and that we're going to just fire them. No. They knew and should have acted before, and my guess is that they will suffer some liability. Someone's going to come forward because they were in a position to be required to protect their employees, and they didn't.
Very well stated. And that's something, I mean, you just clarified a few things for me in the past few minutes, even though most people, the clarification was necessary, I think, from the two types of sexual harassment, going back a little bit in the conversation to mm-hmm. what you just stated now. So thank you for that. By the way, our guest is Lori Lowenthal Marcus. Follow her on Twitter at Lori L. Marcus on Twitter. I just now followed her, and I'm anxious to see what she's got to write henceforth, and I'll be going through her Twitter feed, but at Lori L. Marcus on Twitter, and of course her Facebook as well.
I want to jump in here with something that you have in your article, the big law firm Casting Couch, where we see that a lot of these sexual harassment allegations and sexual assault allegations, unless it's in the statute of limitations, most of the, at least the assault, are not going to be carried out any justice in the court of law. But you talk about a litigation in your article here about other women who you worked with who you used your story of sexual harassment to gain money for themselves. Can you explain that a little bit?
When I had my experience at the law firm where I worked, it was sexual harassment, but I went to the partner the next morning and I told that partner that if he ever does anything like that again, I was going to report him. And if he never does, then that this is the end of the story. Now, I did tell one or two other women in the firm about what happened. And in part, it was because it was around the same time as the whole Clarence Thomas hearings. And so there was a lot of discussion about sexual harassment. And some of my colleagues had said, well, if any man ever did that to me, I would report them immediately. And, you know, I tried to explain, you know, it's easy to say that you would be very brave in a traumatic situation, but unless you've been in it, you don't know. Anyway, a few months later, a number of women at the firm where I worked, I think it was 11 women, were fired, were let go. And it wasn't, I don't think it was because they had done anything in particular wrong. I think they just were downsizing. But almost all of the people fired or let go were women. So the women, those women who were fired, apparently, as I later learned, went to a lawyer and decided to sue the firm for sex discrimination. It wasn't about sexual harassment. It was about sex discrimination. But they put in to show bad feelings and bad behavior on the part of the law firm towards women, they put in a description of what had happened to me, never asking me if that was okay. And, of course, they were using this because they were trying to get a settlement from the firm, which they did get. They got money from the firm, so they didn't have to go to court. They did file a complaint, though. And I was told by one of the partners in the law firm that the description of what happened to me was the, quote, juiciest thing in the complaint. So, I mean, I was really hurt by that and angry that my tragedy was used by others for monetary gain.
Right.
And the reason I put that anecdote in this particular article is that when I was writing the article, it was after the initial Harvey Weinstein stories had come out. And I began to see on Twitter and elsewhere in social media, some people saying, oh, well, this is all about white men taking advantage of everybody else.
That was the topic of conversation here as well. Thank you for, okay, go ahead.
So I wanted to make it clear that all kinds of people can be horrible and in different ways. And these were not only women and white women and some of them had been my friends, but they saw they believed that they could benefit financially from my story, and so they did, not caring about what happened to me. And by the way, and I included this in the article, the woman lawyer that they went to was an African American woman, and she wrote the complaint, and it was her obligation as a lawyer to make sure that the facts she included in her complaint were truthful. And she never contacted me either. She didn't care to even do her job as a lawyer, forget about hurting another woman. And so I just wanted to bring that out. And I also brought out that the one person to whom I turned for help, the one person that I could count on, because if you read the article, you'll see that a U.S. senator became involved.
Yep.
In a bizarre twist, because this senator was about to hire the person who had harassed me, and I wanted to warn him about this person's propensity towards bad behavior. And Washington, D.C., as we know, is a place where men with power or people of others, and instead of taking my warning, he then turned on me and tried to get me to say it wasn't such a big deal. Anyway, to have a U.S. senator going after you anywhere is difficult. And in Philadelphia, which is where I am and where I was practicing, I couldn't figure out who I could get to help me. And so I then called on a professor I had had at Harvard Law School, a black man, a black professor, Charles Ogletree, and he came to my assistance in a way that was enormously helpful, and I'm very grateful to him. But I wanted to show, you know, that people can be really good and really bad, and it's not because of one's race. It's just, I think, if you're a good person or not.
Right.
And that's so everyone has to be careful.
Very well said. In your article that appears on the American Thinker, really, folks, you've got to read this article, by our guest. It's titled The Big Law Firm Casting Couch. And of course, there are other articles, but this one, the latest, and it's very topical given the headlines of today. Lori, one of the questions that we all seem to have here at the studio, and we've been talking about this, and perhaps you may have answered it already, maybe not directly, but indirectly. Why are we seeing now the flood of, it seems like all of a sudden the gates have opened, and we've seen so many people come forward, whether it's a year, a month, or 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's this phenomenon that we're seeing? What's
causing this? This sounds very trite, and I don't mean it to be trite, but I think it has something to do with a phenomenon of when you're in a supermarket and there's no one online, and then one person gets online, and all of a sudden, everyone is online. It's just this pack mentality. And not to say that the stories that are coming out aren't true. It's just there was a trigger, and that did open the floodgates. And the Harvey Weinstein story was so extreme and so grotesque that people did begin to say, well, yes, that's what happens to people who are in vulnerable positions. And lots of people said, yeah, that happened to me, and I never said anything. But you know what? The person shouldn't have gotten away with it. And so they're not bringing litigation because, as you mentioned, lots of these instances are way in the past. But just naming it, I do understand that emotional response. The problem, of course, becomes it just swings too far, and everyone wants to get involved. Yeah, that happened to me too. And sometimes the stories that they're telling, no, it didn't happen. That wasn't sexual harassment. You felt bad about something that happened, but, you know, put on your big girl pants and let's say someone was rude, someone was horrible. Okay, move on. You know, sexual harassment doesn't happen except in the workplace. It's not just free-floating bad behavior. There's protection because women used to be the ones, and still largely are, the ones in the lower levels of the power structure in employment, and there needed to be a way to protect them. But it's not about, you know, policing social interactions generally. And I think people really need to understand that. They really need to know. It's kind of like in the world of, here's a law geek talking, but in the world of torts, when something bad happens, you don't get to say, oh, this bad thing happens, I'm going to court. No, unless you were damaged, and I mean damaged, you can show that you were harmed. You don't have a cause of action. You had something bad that happened to you. That's it.
You know, as opposed to hurt feelings.
Right.
Yeah. Boy, I'll tell you what. If you're still practicing, I need your number. No, I'm kidding. And certainly. Wow. And that very important distinction that however, okay. You know, and now, if I can ask you this one question, taking politics out of this, just removing politics, another question that we have discussed and we often have gotten ourselves and we reference is the situation with Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and Hillary knowing, for example, again, politics aside just momentarily, but knowing that the, if we can't extract politics from this, knowing that what Hillary Clinton allegedly knew in covering and enabling Bill's behavior. Any thoughts on that situation?
I'm not sure how to take politics out of it.
Yeah. Maybe that was kind of an unfair question, I suppose, because of the power, the innate power of the office. And
well, no, we're talking, no, what he did was wrong. We're talking about Hillary's response. And the reason I'm reluctant, because I am angry that someone in her position allowed what she allowed her husband to do. She knew about it. And what I'm most bothered by is what I believe to be her trashing of some of the women, I guess all of the women who came forward,
right,
and made claims. That's wrong. It's wrong for anyone to cover up someone's bad activities just because you want to get a goodie at the end, because you want to be president someday, you want to be senator just someday, you want to get that raise. I mean, that's just bad behavior, and it isn't because she's a Democrat or she's, you know, or someone else is a Republican. That's just wrong, and it's wrong for a woman, particularly one who holds herself out as this, you know, icon of feminism. That was bad.
Exactly, and part of the reason why I asked that, in addition to, of course, the fact that we discuss it, and we've gotten questions about this, but my wife and I were talking about this, and she said, you know, if you would ever think that I would stand by your side or cover,
you've got nothing coming.
That's right. You're going to be out the door, and I have to, obviously. Because that's just the right thing to do, and I just see this perversity that took place, and I, you know, especially for someone who stands up for women's rights or allegedly stands up for women's rights. I don't know. I wanted to ask that question, just because it
was, you were thinking about it, and yeah. You know, it's an obvious question, and it's clearly a level of hypocrisy that is deeply disturbing, but. Again, we need to be careful. Right now, we're seeing all kinds of allegations, and we do need to make sure that they are founded allegations, that we're not, you know, as you mentioned earlier, we're not just throwing out due process.
Right.
Because I do think that there is soon going to be a wave of attacks against people, you know, attacks on their character, whether or not they're well-founded, and we all need to be wary of that, regardless of which side of the aisle it happens on.
I agree. And I often think, too, and boy, I'll tell you what, the policy of Mike Pence, I think, is a pretty good policy. You know what? And my wife and I have talked about this before. I'm going to tell you right now, I will never, ever be alone with a woman anywhere. And that's not to disparage women. It's just so... there's no chance of,
you know, in the Orthodox Jewish community, that is the standard. You don't do that. You don't go into a room and have the door shut if it's unmarried people together. So it's something, when I heard Mike Pence did that, I thought, wow, you know, I'm very familiar with that behavior. And it kind of surprised me that people thought that was funny or weird. Yeah. And shame on them. And now they know better.
Indeed. So there is, you are able to compliment a woman on her fine dress. You're able to compliment a woman on her appearance. You're able to be a gentleman without fear of being called a, you know, a sexual abuser, as you have.
Well, no. You could fear it because you might be called it, but it just won't be accurate.
Okay. All right. Again, a distinction with a significant difference there.
Yeah. And also, you know, if you just read a transcript, he said her dress looked nice. That sounds so innocuous.
Right.
But of course we know sometimes there's a leer and there's, you know, looming over somebody. So, these sexual harassment investigations that I did and when I gave the seminars, you have to really pay attention. They're all very fact specific. And so the armchair, lawyers and judges, really are doing a disservice when they say, oh, I know what happened, because you don't.
Okay. And thank you for that. Thank you for that correction, clarification.
I wasn't saying you don't.
No.
In general.
And I get that. And I think our audience gets that as well. Wow. This has been a fascinating hour, from Jerusalem to, you know, from the good news, with respect to the government operations to, of course, the more sultry, ugly news, about sexual harassment in the workplace and beyond. So you are just a fountain of knowledge, and thank you so much for your gracious gift of time tonight. We really appreciate your writing. We appreciate you coming on our show, and we hope that you'd consider coming on again at some future point.
I sure would. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you guys.
Fantastic. And again, what a gracious lady. Thank you so very much. What a gracious lady, the author, an author for American Thinker. You know, you can follow her on Twitter. I just did, and I just bounced from the page there. Lori Lorenthal Marcus, American Thinker, at Lori L. Marcus is her Twitter handle. Of course, on Facebook as well. Gracious lady, attorney, very knowledgeable. Everything from the Middle East to sexual harassment. My goodness. You're listening to the Hagmann Report. Network break.